everybody. Welcome to the Sobriety Plus Group Saturday Night Speaker Meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. My name is Jolene, and I am an alcoholic.
Hey, Jolene.
Please take this time to turn off all cell phones. We are going to have a moment of silence to do with, if you see, well, excuse me, we're going to have this serenity prayer right here. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. We're glad you're all here, especially the newcomer. Are there any newcomers this evening that would like to introduce themselves so we might get to know you? Hi, Steve. Welcome. Are there any visitors from other groups that would like to be recognized? Okay. So newcomers, if you need a newcomer packet with some phone numbers, please get with me after the meeting. The group conscious asks that you have 1 year of continuous sobriety to chair this meeting. And at this time, I'm going to read the preamble of Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contribution. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. And I had asked another person to speak, Joe, but there was a death in his family. And I asked Kevin to speak on a pretty short notice, and this gentleman was so kind and said he would do it. I have heard nothing from this wonderful person, from my sponsor and many others in AA. And what we do here, we don't really read how it works or anything, because our speaker is going to explain his experience, strength, and hope, and how it works for him. And this is Kevin.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Kevin Haggerty. I am a recovered alcoholic. And I'm going to start out by saying those who say that they're recovering aren't, because I have a book here that shows me precisely how to recover from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body that we call alcoholism. And if you're one of those people running around here saying that you're recovering and you have longer than 6 months, stop doing that, because either you don't understand the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I will be more than happy to show it to you, or, you know, we're just perpetuating lies in Alcoholics Anonymous. This is my fourth time doing this in the last month, and I was thinking about that, and I'm getting kind of bored of listening to my own story, and I thought I might tell somebody else's story. And I was talking to one of my friends, and she says, "Well, tell my story." And I thought, well, maybe I could do that. But I want to tell a story about an alcoholic, a real alcoholic. And this man was in the Army, and while he was in the Army, him and his buddy were out drinking one night, and he says, "You know, you're too drunk, I'm gonna drive." And so he took the keys from his buddy, and of course he ran the car straight into a tree, and the steering wheel went into his chest. And while he was in the hospital, they took out one of his lungs, and he met this cute little nurse, and you know, she took a shine to him, and she up and married that guy, and off they went, and they had a family. And you know, she didn't know at the time that this man was a real alcoholic, type described in this book right here. And they started a little family, and they had a bunch of little kids, and you know, those kids looked up to their dad, and they looked up to their father, and they said, you know, but here was this guy, and he just couldn't stop drinking. And there's a story about him that tells about him sitting in the living room of his family's house, and he wanted so bad not to drink anymore that he took a knife and he put it in his stomach because he didn't want to drink. And unfortunately, what happened is they took him to the hospital and they pumped him back full of morphine again, and that guy was off to the races. You know, a man died when he was 35 years old, and his name was Joseph Haggerty, and he was my father. And people like that have been dying in my family for a long time. And, you know, in 1972, when he died from this disease, Alcoholics Anonymous wasn't as strong as it was today. I don't know if my dad would have ever found the answer that I found here. Because my old man died is not what makes me alcoholic. I was a kid running around in my neighborhood, hanging around with everybody. You know, by all outside circumstances, we all looked the same. We were all the same age, went to the same school, same teachers. We all were riding bicycles, stealing lawnmowers, smoking cigarettes, huffing gas, smoking pot. And you know, if you would have looked at all of us from the outside, you'd have said, you know, y'all look the same to us. But you know what? Inside, I felt so different from them. I never felt like I fit in that group. Your outsides have never looked like I felt on the inside my whole life. And I'm a thief. I'm a thief. I'm not an alcoholic thief. I'm a thief because I was stealing money out of my mom's purse long before I ever took a drink. And I stole $5 out of her purse one day, and instead of going to buy some pot. Drugs are part of my story, and for you old timers who aren't cool with that, this is just an opportunity for you all to grow. I went and I stole some money out of her purse, and we went up to 7-Eleven, and this is going to date me, for those of you who don't get this. 7-Eleven was open from 7 o'clock in the morning till 11 o'clock at night. And a six-pack of Miller High Life cost $2.65. And we went out, we got that six pack, and we went out behind that 7-Eleven, and it was like magic happened. You know, when Dr. Carl Jung wrote there's a solution that ideas, attitudes, and emotions that are once the guiding force of the lives of these men are suddenly cast to one side, and I'm completely dominated by a brand new set of concepts and motives. I had the courage to go over there and talk to those little girlies. I had, you know, all of a sudden I fit in with, not only did I fit in with those guys I was running with, I was better than them. And the next time I stole money, we weren't going to buy any more pot. We were going right back up there. And you know what? I'm getting my own six pack. And y'all, I don't fend for yourself because I found what I was looking for. Now, I'd like to sit up here and I would like to tell you guys about all the DUIs that I've had and all the jails that I've been into and all of those things where alcohol has taken me through. And if I did that, somebody in this room would say, you know, I ain't never done that, so I must not be one of you. In our preamble, it says that we share in a common problem and a common solution. My common problem is that once I get started drinking, I can't stop. And the other half of that is once I get myself stopped, I can't keep myself stopped. I'm a big book fanatic and a fundamental orthodox big book thumping guy. And if you don't like that, you might as well go smoke now because what I'm going to talk about is going to come right out of this book. And we were cruising through this the other night, and you know, in Bill's story, it talks about him writing sweet promises to his wife, and I can remember doing that to my girlfriend when I was 17 years old. I mean, I'm a real alcoholic because I know that because I had a spiritual experience the very first time I drank. I don't know when the book talks about crossing a line. I don't know about that. Alcohol did everything for me just like that, in a blink of an eye. And I chased that relentlessly. Now, I've got some stories about Alcoholics Anonymous, and one of those goes is that I showed up to the fellowship. You know, part of me being here tonight is part of my ninth step amends. somewhere in 1994 or 1995, I spoke at this group. And I sat up here and I talked about codependency and sex and love, Addicts Anonymous and food addiction and all kinds of crap because I didn't know what I was talking about. I thought I was supposed to get up here and I was supposed to tell you this wonderful flowery story about me. And God, thank God that's not what I have today. I've been taught by the very best that Alcoholics Anonymous has to offer. And my buddy Joe has probably tried to pollute some of you people with the speaker tapes of Joe Hawk, Mark Houston, Don Pritz, Bob Olson, Big Frank McKibben, all these cats who came out of Denver. And they showed me a way of working with this book that nobody has ever showed me, never taken the time to show me. I've said for a long time that I've been in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, when they opened up the title page and they explained to me the circle and the triangle, I understood that I had never been in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the program of Alcoholics Anonymous today, for me, is a very sacred thing. And I'm talking, of course, about the recovery portion, the service portion. I'm still having a little trouble swallowing the unity portion, but I'm liking some of you a little bit better as the days go along. I don't love all of you, but I do like most of you. And, you know, my book, and it, when I go through the chapter of There's a Solution, it says we are people who are normally not mixed. And, you know, with when, there's something that goes off. I meet people in the fellowship of the Spirit today, and I can tell because it's like our spirits start talking before, just as we introduce ourselves. I know that you've been where I've been, you've done what I've done, and you've done the work the way that I've done the work. You know, that we've gotten clear on who and what we are long before we even start. Like I say, I came to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous in 1991. And I came because I was homeless, jobless, unemployable, and I just, you know, I was not very successful at life. I can never remember going to my junior high school guidance counselor saying, is there a program by age 28? I can be homeless and jobless and a complete failure at life. I don't ever remember doing that. But in and of my best doing, that's about all I can accomplish. And so I had a little tiny gun. At that time it was a 22. And I'm sitting there, I got this little 22 in one hand and I got a six pack in the other hand, and I just want to die inside. And if you're a real alcoholic, you understand that. And I'm too scared because I'm sitting there and I'm shooting empty beer cans with the gun and I'm going, that's a very small hole. And, you know, I can just envision me being a vegetable and somebody's burden for the rest of my entire life because I know that that gun's not big enough to do the job. I called out for help and I went to a treatment center and I spent 30 days of getting crammed into my head some of the worst information that you can ever put into an alcoholic's head. And it took me well over 10 years to get rid of all those ideas that I learned in the treatment center. I've been to a couple of them, too. I went, I spent 6 months in a halfway house. And while I was in that halfway house, I'm one of those guys who knows how to push the envelope. I could push the rule just until it's getting ready to break, and I go, okay, that's enough. But that's the kind of guy I am. I've always done that my whole life. I'll push you right until I can get you to go over the edge, and I'll back off. What I'm going to attempt to do up here tonight is, you know, my book says that each person in the personal stories tells in his own language, from his own way, own point of view, the way he establishes his relationship with God. And that's what I intend to do up here. And hopefully you hear nothing else that comes out of my mouth, because that's the most important fact of my life today. You know, when I got here in 91, mind you, I was able to stay sober 6.5 years on pure grace alone. Walking through life, sound asleep, dreaming I'm awake. I actually thought I knew what the program was all about, and I had no clue. I thought I was actually doing the steps, and I wasn't. And I was basically doing nothing more than going to movies, playing softball, and playing grab ass. And I was pretty good at them all. I would say that I was going to a lot of big book meetings, and I was going to them because I wanted to build a firm foundation. And, you know, at that time, my book was broken at page 65 because I could never get past the inventory portion. After living a lie for a while and marrying some lady I had no business marrying, through a series of operations, you know, there are two things in this world that will fix a spiritual malady. One of them is a spiritual experience. The other one is pharmaceutical or narcotics. And if you have trouble getting those, you know, they have no problem dishing those out if you're going to go get a lot of operations. And I was a guy who had 6 operations in 4 years. And all of them were on different parts of my body. In fact, I had an operation on my shoulder one day, and they took out my tonsils the very next day. And at age 36, that was extremely painful. And I don't suggest anybody ever do that. But, you know, I was willing to go to any lengths to get what I needed. In August of 2002, I managed to get to that place where I think every alcoholic gets one more time. And for me, it's a place I visit very often. It's a place where I say, thank you so much, God, for letting me be a part of this life, but I don't wish to participate anymore. I'd like to cash in my chips, and I don't want to play anymore. And I take everything, single thing in the house, and I drink everything in the house, and I lay down, and I just want to cash out. I'm done. And, you know, in the chapter of We Agnostics, it says, to be doomed to an alcoholic death or to live a spiritual way of life aren't easy alternatives to face. And, you know, thank God that those people who got me up and started working me through this process said, "God, Kevin, you're not even doing a good job of dying an alcoholic death." And I went, "You know, you're right. I've got an accidental overdose when I was 12. I've got intentional overdoses. You know, times when I've been in car accidents I should not walk away from." And I'm sitting there and I'm looking back over my life and my experience going, "Oh, shit." Now, I had a brother-in-law of mine who was able to die from this alcoholic death that we talked about. You know, did he have a purpose left? I don't know. But I've come to believe that I do have a purpose left. And the ability to be able to touch and affect somebody's life in a positive manner today is one of those things. You know, I got to that place and I went to treatment one more time, and I'm going to meetings at the Winter Park Group, and I'm holding on to one of those white chairs until my knuckles are turning white. And I'm wishing, and the only prayer that could come out of my mouth at that time is, "God, please make it like it used to be." Thank God I don't get what I pray for. If I would have got what I prayed for, I would have sold myself so short. 6 months later, and I could usually last about 6 months in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous without writing any inventory before it gets back. And you know what I'm talking about it when I talk about it. it is that spiritual malady, the fact that I'm restless, irritable, discontent. I'm prey to misery and depression. I'm full of fear. I can't seem to be of real usefulness to other people. I can't control my emotional nature. And the very, very worst one of all is that I'm having trouble with personal relations. See, I don't like who and what I've become. I don't like where I'm at, how I got here, and the fact that, you know, I don't even need a cell phone because ain't nobody calling. Ain't nobody taking my calls. I'm an absolute miserable failure at dying, and I'm an absolute miserable failure at living. And one more time, I reach out for some help, and I get a friend of mine, and she hauls me off to the meeting at Central at 6:30 in the morning. And I was talking to her. I said, "You know, how you been able to stay sober?" And she says, "I don't know what it is about the 6:30 in the morning meeting, Kevin, but I don't like those old crusty bastards there. I don't like anything they have to say." But she says, "You know, I keep going, and I've been sober ever since I keep going there. I've been sober." So I start going, and I reluctantly find some guy, and I, you know, eke out those pitiful words that every one of them, will you sponsor me? And you know, so the gentleman pulls out a business card. He writes on the back of that business card and says, "Go to a meeting every day for 30 days. Call me every night for 30 nights. And shut your mouth in a meeting. Just your name and that you're alcoholic and pass." And I'm looking at this and going, "You don't understand. I had 6 years..." Shh, quiet. If you knew anything about how to stay sober, we would not be having this conversation. And for the very first time, somebody told me the truth about myself, despite my sensitive little alcoholic feelings. That man hit me with a 2x4 right there, right between the eyes. And he was right. For the first time in my life, I went, Well, I'm so full of pride and arrogance, you know, I still think I know what I'm doing. And I did not follow the directions on the back of that card. And within a week, I was drunk again. And one more time. You know, it's bad enough coming in and picking up one white chip, but to do it over and over and over again. And I think that there's such demoralization in that because I don't understand what it means to be powerless. I don't understand that I don't have a choice whether I pick it up or I don't pick it up. And thank God those people showed me. I went back in there, picked up one more white chip, and he was there. And he came up to me and he says, "Is there anything I can do for you?" And those words, you know, "Can we try this again?" He comes back, he says, "Do what's on the back of the card." And for the very first time in my life, I began to do something else besides my idea. I began to submit myself to a way other than my own. And that man took me through the steps very quickly. I called every single day. And it took 3 weeks for a genius like me, a ninth grade dropout with a JLED, to figure out hey, I'm getting the answer machine. Yes, it's me. No, I didn't drink. I'll call you tomorrow. Click. You know, I was so scared to call this guy every single day, and that's all I had to report. Yes, I went to a meeting. No, I didn't drink. I'll call you tomorrow. That was all he wanted. And that was my willingness to display. That was the most I could get out, was following some stupid, simple little directions that says, my way don't work, and I'm willing to try your way. At about 3 weeks, he gave me a box, and there were 8 tapes in there. And he says, here, I want you to listen to these. And I looked at them, and some guy named Don Majors, and I threw them on the front seat of my truck, and I went, what good is that? You know, I've been to speaker meetings before, and God, there's a painful to sit through, you know, to listen to somebody get up there and tell about their childhood, that they're alcoholic because their mama had a square nipple or something, and I'm going, what? And so I'm sitting there and I'm listening, and you know, it starts to come back. You know, I'm pissed off at those old guys in that meeting, and I don't want to be there anymore, and reluctantly I pull out the very first tape and I throw it in my cassette deck, and I began to hear a message of Alcoholics Anonymous I never heard before. And this guy was talking like nobody I'd ever heard before. And every single time this gentleman started one of his sessions off of those 8 tapes, and there were 16 times he did this, he started out every single time with a simple little prayer. And that prayer was, God, please set aside what I think I know about these steps, about this process, about this program, about myself, and most of all, God, what I think I know about you. For an open mind and open heart for new experience. For the experience I'm having right now, I do real well with. Please help me to see the world through the eyes of a child again. And you know what? He talked about being a street needle junkie and that he was too smart to get this program. And he says, he started to get down on his knees and he started to use that prayer, and he said, something changed. And I said, God, if it'll work for him, maybe it'll work for me. So I go to this house that I'm living in that my family has put me up in, and I'm not paying any rent in, and I make sure that all the blinds are closed because I live in there by myself, and God forbid anybody see me on my knees praying. And I began to say that prayer. And it began to become so important because, see, I didn't understand. I always thought my belief system has always been that I needed to think, feel, or believe that something was going to work before I did it, to have it actually work. And they said, no. We just want you to do what we tell you to do. Wow, that's kind of a new idea for me. And so I started doing that. And most of the time I got on my knees, all I could hear was my voice reverberating off the walls. I didn't think it was going to work. I didn't feel like it was going to work. And I damn sure didn't believe it was going to work. But it's something changed. In our book and in the chapter of Weagnostics, it says that scales of pride and prejudice fell from our eyes. A new world came into view. Bill's story describes that. And in how it works, it says some of us tried to hold on to our old ideas and the result was nil until we let go absolutely. Now, I'm not bright enough to know what ideas I need to get rid of and which ones I need to keep. And I'm not smart enough to know how to open my own mind. You know, I've got a friend of mine who tells a story. He tells a story about finding a hunting dog. And he takes the hunting dog out, and he goes out hunting some ducks, and he shoots some ducks, and this dog goes running across the top of the water. The dog walks across water and retrieves the duck. He thinks he's done enough, found it. So he does it a couple more times. He shoots the duck, the dog goes walking across the water. He goes home, and he gets this drunk who lives next door to him. So he says, Dale, you got to come over here. You've got to check this out. He takes him out and dunk on it. And Dale's sitting there watching, he's just having the time of his life, and he's shooting these ducks, and the dog just keeps walking across the water. And he looks over and says, Dale, you know the same thing funny about that dog? And he says, you know, the poor thing can't swim. And that's the mind that I bring to Alcoholics Anonymous. I can't open my own mind. You know, and it was the very first time I began to trust and rely upon something else besides me. You know, me and my sponsor got down in that little termite-ridden shack over there at Central. And we were back there, and we did a third step. And I can't tell you how many third steps I've ever done. And I can tell you I've done a whole bunch of them. Never understood what the prayer meant. Could never, ever meet the requirement of the third step. And if you don't know that there's a requirement, you maybe You know, I was one of those guys who worked steps off the wall for a long time, and I had some off-the-wall shit. So, I met the first requirement. I was finally convinced that any part of my life run by me was going to be a big, heavy, steamy pile of bug shit. And, you know, that's what it was. 40 years of existence, and that's all I can do, over and over and over again. It's not hard to see that when you're an alcoholic of my type. I didn't know what they meant when it said that we had to quit playing God, but I had kind of an idea. You know, I got down on my knees and I said that prayer with a sponsor and never understood it. And I heard a guy on a tape a while ago, or, you know, shortly after that, he told me what that prayer meant. But God, I offer myself to thee to do with me and build with me as thou wilt. Kevin, that means your life is no longer your business. Who's in your life, who's not in your life, where you work, how much money you make is none of your damn business anymore. You know, I start to look at that. And every time I make that stuff my business, I go batshit crazy. You know, I need to have her, and I need to have this much money, and I need to have this kind of respect from you, and I'm like, oh, God. And I start to get in touch with that. It says, relieve me of the bondage of self. Maybe so I can write my inventory. Take away my difficulties so that victory over them will bear witness to those I will help with thy power, thy love, and thy will of life. Kevin, if you're not willing to take anybody else through this work, God's not going to take away your difficulties. I'm here to tell you that one of the clues that I have found out about Alcoholics Anonymous is I just keep working with other drunks. I don't worry about those chicken shit problems I have over there that a lot of us like to talk about in our meetings, but I don't worry about that stuff. Because if I know, if I just keep my nose in the book and I keep showing drunks what I know about this book and show them precisely how to recover, that God will take care of those little things that I will run around in circles trying to fix all the time. I got up off my knees and my sponsor sent me home to go write some inventory. And we had been to a four-step seminar and I got a little gist of what's going on here. And he says, go home and write a list of names. And I went home and I wrote a list of names. I came back the next day and he said, did you do that? I said, yeah, sure did. And he said, good. He said, go home and I want you to write down the causes. And I went down and I write down the causes. Man, I love the first two columns. That son of a bitch did this and they did that. You gotta love that stuff. He sent me home and he says, I want you to fill out the third column. How to fix your pride, your self-esteem. You know, I still got a mind of an chronic alcoholic. And I want to vote stupid. You know, and I go home and I don't do that stuff. And by this time, I had become my own little speaker tape junkie. You know, I started to order my own tapes. And on one of the tapes, I heard this guy talking about the very first time he ever lied to his sponsor. And I went, son of a bitch. I don't get the message of Alcoholics Anonymous through people in the fellowship here. I get it through them speaker tapes. And, I heard that guy and I said, damn, you know. The only thing I knew to do was shut myself up in the house. And I shut myself up in there Friday night, Saturday night, Sunday, and Sunday night. By the time Sunday night came around, I had completed a resentment inventory, a three-column fear inventory, and a nine-column sex inventory. And I had finally seen the truth about me. You know, the truth about me was that I didn't know how to have a relationship with a male or a female. That I was driven. My whole life has been driven out of fear. I love that statement in the fear inventory that says, it is an evil and corroding thread. The fabric of my existence is shot through with that. You know, and I still see some of that today in a lot of our people in our fellowship. You know, in Bill's story it says, alcohol was my master. You know, and I can't serve two masters today. I'm either going to hate one and love the other one. And, you know, so I don't keep my eyes fixed on this as about booze, because booze was never my problem. Booze has always been my solution. My sponsor at the time, I think he was a great Clancy fan. And Clancy would always talk about driving those guys down Pacific Coast Highway with a flashlight and having the guys read their inventory. And, you know, he hooked up a boat and we had to go to St. Augustine. And you ever try riding in a truck reading inventory when that thing's bouncing like this? And, God, you know, you think we'd sit somewhere and, you know, under a tree. And no, and we were going across the St. John's River Bridge. And, you know, I got it. My whole life I've been trying. You know, my whole life growing up, I wanted to be just like my dad. And when I was 8 years old, I watched him close the coffin on him. And I knew I never wanted to be like him. And then I just could not be like him. I was part of him, and all of a sudden, when we were going across the St. John Vianney Bridge, and I'm watching the sun setting, and it's behind us, and I'm looking out, and all of a sudden, I got the message. You know, Kevin, you're supposed to be the man that your father could never be. I'm 9 years older than when my old man died, and I never thought I was going to be here. I never thought. I have always imagined dying before I was 35 years old. I mean, that was it. That was the pinnacle. That was old age for me. You know, I got done with that inventory, and everything came out in that stuff. All of the stuff that I had in our fifth step, you know, it says I'm revolted by some of the things I do in my sprees, and as quickly as I can, I push these things far down inside of myself, hoping that they never see the light of day. And thank God I've had some teachers who have helped me get to my truth because they got to their truth. They were diligent enough to stay in this work and get to their truth so that I could get free of my truth. And those guys helped get me free. You know, my sponsor at the time had edited my amends list. I want you to go send flowers to all these women. And I thought, God, that seems kind of cheesy. You know, my sister is in this fellowship also, and she says, it says here, we make direct amends. And so I had to sit with that one for a while. I went around and I started repairing the damage in my past. I came here 4.5 years ago and I was $40,000 in debt. And this last spring I sent off the last $11,000 of that debt. That debt note. And 4.5 years ago I could not see it like the end of the tunnel. Could not see it, people. And I never knew how it was going to get done, but the program of Alcoholics Anonymous has made that come true for me. I went around and I cleaned up some stuff with my family. And you know, one of those guys on one of those speaker tapes always lit a fire under my butt. His name is Joe Hoffman. He said, it was a simple little prayer. And it says, God, please show me if my unfinished amends have anything to do with me drinking again. You know, when I got sober in the early 90s, I had written a little, one of those chicken shit Hazelden check mark boxes, things of inventory, and I went around to those people who I knew what the response was that I was good. Never once did I take the bit in my teeth and go to those people that I did not like and say, I have wronged you, and I'm here to clean this up. And I got a very clear idea and a very clear touch that my unfinished amends always have something to do with me drinking again. And even if I'm aware of them or not. You know, I've struggled in employment. I show up on the job, man, and I'm here and I got my Superman cape on. And about 6 weeks later, I wonder how come they haven't made me the vice president of the company, why I have not been able to take my vacation yet. You know, and I start to see that I have my whole employment life is spent seeing what I could take from the company rather than I could give to it. Whether that I could make sure that I was going to have a job next week because I was being a productive part of this little, I was being the cog in the wheel instead of wanting to be the wheel. You know, as I went and I cleaned up this past, I began to look at the big book, and the big book talks about the spiritual disciplines of 10 and 11. You know, I continue to ask, watch, turn. They're all spiritual practices. You know, and how well do I treat the person at 7-Eleven today? How well do I treat the people, you know, who are just like I was, walking around, sound asleep, dreaming they're awake? You know, we all talk about this fact that we have road rage in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I don't know why. You know, I wrote enough inventory to see that I'm pitching a bitch about an 8-foot stretch of road that I'm on for about 1 second. Maybe even less than that. And I keep thinking, you know, it came to me, I don't know what's going on in their life. I don't know if they've got a loved one at home that they're rushing home to, if they've got a kid in school that they need to go pick up, or somebody just ran over their dog. I don't know. Those are the hardest words that ever come out of my mouth. But I don't know. You know, the big book gives me a lot of freedom. A lot of freedom to begin to seek out this thing we call spirituality. And, you know, some of my biggest barriers between spirituality and religion, that's a tough one, guys. And hopefully you run around some of the teachers that I run across. I've got a book at home. It's called Spiritual Sobriety, Recovering What Religion's Lost. There's another book also. It's called It's All Bullshit and Why Knowing It Will Set You Free. And, you know, and in those books, those people taught me things. You know, religious people go to the four corners of the earth and they want everybody to believe just like they believe. And spiritual people believe that only 5% of the people walking around on this face of this earth are actually awake. We really don't care what it is you believe. We just want to know how's it working for you. You know, and if you're one of those people who are out there and you just can't seem to stop drinking, or your life really sucks, it's not Alcoholics Anonymous' fault. You know, I got into my evangelical stage at about 60 days sober because I had a spiritual experience. And because I had that spiritual experience, you know, my life has been changed. I am not the same man sitting up here that I was when I came here. I'm not the same guy I was describing. I have been changed. My book says I'm going to be placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. I have not even sworn it off. Instead, the problem has been removed. Well, what's my problem? My problem's not alcohol and drugs. My problem is my selfishness and my self-centeredness. You know, I answer my phone all the time. And I don't care who you are or what kind of trouble you're in. But I make sure to answer my phone because, you know, those people were there for me. And we were talking at a meeting about this today. You know, thank God. The topic at the meeting today was, you know, why do you keep coming back to AA? And I can remember standing outside Central and I got alligator tears coming out of my mouth and I'm talking out of my eyes and I'm talking to my sponsor and I'm saying, how can I ever thank you for doing this for me? And he says, go do it for somebody else, Kevin. See, I don't know if it's the very first guy that I help or the very next guy that I help or 50 or more down the road that I help to recover from this nasty illness. I don't know when my job's going to be done. I just keep doing my job. You know, in working with others, it says, your job now is to be of maximum service to God and your fellow man. Do not hesitate to be on the firing line of life. You know, my firing, what does your firing line look like? I love going to detox. I love going to 33rd Street Jail. You know, the fact that I carry the message from where I got it and I take it to a place that they don't have it is what carry means. Carrying the message does not mean that I sit in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and think, oh God, I wonder what the topic's going to be today. Because don't ever let that happen when I'm in a room because I've got some crazy topics. Like, what does the world of the Spirit look like for you? I brought some things along and I always like to share these when I do one of these little pitches because you guys need to know. I think you need to know and I don't know who I'm going to touch anyway. For those of you who know me, I got four dogs at home, and they weigh 500 pounds. So you can do the math. There's a lot of dogs there. And, you know, in the beginning, I wish I would have found stuff like this, but it took me a little later on in life. And it says if a dog was your sponsor, you would learn stuff like when loved ones come home, always run to greet them. Never pass up the opportunity to go for a joyride. Allow the experience of fresh air and the wind in your hair to be pure ecstasy. When it's in your best interest, practice obedience. Let others know when they invade your territory. Take naps and stretch before rising. Run, romp, and play daily. Thrive on attention and let people touch you. Avoid biting when a simple growl will do. On warm days, stop to lie on your back in the grass. On hot days, drink lots of water and lay under a shady tree. When you're happy, dance around and rag your entire body. No matter how often you're scolded, don't buy into the guilt thing and pout. Run right back and make friends. Delight in the simple joy of a long walk. Eat with gusto and enthusiasm and stop when you've had enough. Be loyal. And if what you want lies buried, dig until you find it. And when someone's having a bad day, be silent, sit close by, and nuzzle them gently. And those are the things my dog teaches me. You know, and no matter how bad my day is, when I go out there and I come back into this, my dogs are there and they're glad to see me. And they don't care how bad, and you know what, it changes me just like that. And it doesn't care the worries of the world. You know, I'd never bought a house before. It was a big experience. When they say don't do anything and, you know, don't make any big decisions in your first year, bullshit. 60 days sober, I knew that I was married to the wrong woman and that I needed to get a divorce. I was not going to be the man that she wanted me to be, and she was never going to be the woman I wanted her to be. And So I needed to get divorced from her. I wanted her to go and find the happiness that she was seeking. And I knew that if I did that, that I may just find the happiness I was looking for. And so I needed to set her free of that. And at 9 months sober, I bought a house. And I've never done that before, and it was quite an experience. And I went, and it was a little chicken shit cracker box house, you know, 2 bedrooms, 1 bath, place falling apart. And I had a knack for tearing stuff up, putting it back together, and it looks all right. And, you know, and I went in there and I did that. And you know, the funny thing is we went and we looked at the house, and I said, well, let's make an offer. And we went and made an offer, and 4 hours later, they said, we accept your offer. And I thought, geez, doesn't it smoke supposed to be tougher than this? Isn't, you know, I see this, because I've got all these screwy ideas about how I think this world works. And, you know, thank God my sister was my real estate agent. She said, Kevin, this is where God wants you. You know, and I've got a cute little yard that's all fenced in and nobody can get in because I got big control. And I got this great big huge sky out there and I've got all these little girls riding their horses right next door and it's just the most serene place in the whole world, you know? When I came in there, it was a little, I looked at it and I went, God, what are we doing moving into a damn crack neighborhood, you know? But that stuff has to start somewhere, and it starts with a guy like me who goes in there and fixes up his house and stays there and leaves some stability in the neighborhood. Maybe that can affect the rest of the neighborhood. You know, I like to be on a positive effect. I've done enough hurting in this world, and I'm tired of hurting people. I didn't want to hurt all them women. So I'm able to put back in this world today, and that's what I love about Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I see this stuff going on and I'm not very happy about it and I want to pass this along to you. And Nelson Mandela wrote it, but he didn't really read it. He stole it from Marianne Williamson. It says our deepest fear is not that we are inadequate. Our deepest fear is that we are powerful beyond measure. It is our light, not our darkness, that most frightens us. You are a child of God. And your playing small doesn't serve the world. There is nothing enlightening about you shrinking so that other people won't feel insecure around you. We were born to manifest the glory of God that is within us. It is not just in some of us. It is in every one of us. And as we let our light shine, we unconsciously give other people permission to do the same. We are liberated from our fear, and our presence automatically liberates others. I don't want anybody walking out of here tonight thinking you can't recover from this nasty, deadly illness. You can get well. My book says that God restores us all to our right minds. And I'm tired of being in meetings and listening to how people say they're still sick and they're still crazy. And if you're still having that kind of experience, come and see me. I'll show you how to do the work. I don't care if you're male, female, young, old. I don't care anymore. I'm just tired of watching people suffer. Because I walked around in this fellowship for a long time suffering. And it doesn't have to happen. But you've got to get to that place where we're willing to capitulate. That was a big word. I didn't know what it meant. It's in the big book. And what it means is it's a surrender agreed upon by both parties. And every time I walk into Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm always willing to surrender on my terms. But I'm not willing to surrender on your terms. So if you're not having fun, and you're not kicking ass and taking names, come see me. And if you don't like my talk, come tell me too. Because I ain't never done this once and somebody come up, I don't like what you have to say. Who's come up and they go, what a great talk, and then they go stab me behind the back later on. Be honest. Tell me you don't like me. That's okay. Most people don't come to a meeting because I know they know I'm going to be there. I got no idea what time it is. But I could probably run on for another 2 hours, but I won't. Thanks, guys.